Finding the right healthcare partner for your business isn't easy, but Hancock Wellbeing at Work can help. We're a different kind of program that combines employer clinics with a wellness strategy. And in a lot of cases, we can deliver greater health benefits at a lower cost. See why well-being for your employees is well-being for your business at HancockWellbeingAtWork.org.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. This is the Second Amendment, and this is the Gun Guy.
Boom, 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 boom. Bang, 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 bang. Boom, 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 boom. Bang, bang, bang.
With Guy Ralford on 93 WIBC.
And good afternoon, and welcome to the Gun Guy Show here on 93 WIBC. We're thrilled you're with us on this spectacular Central Indiana afternoon. It is gorgeous out there. I walked in the studio. It was 68 degrees and sunny and beautiful, and the motorcycles are out on Monument Circle and otherwise, and it puts me in a very good mood. And it's fun to come in here and do radio. We got a lot to talk about, as we always do. Interestingly enough, news just broke yesterday that Hunter Biden, the embattled son of our beloved president, failed in his efforts in court on Friday to have the gun charge against him thrown out. And this is really kind of interesting, and it's got a lot of different layers to it, and it really bears some discussion, because for folks who aren't particularly enamored with the Biden administration, and I would put myself in that group, but those of us who are passionate about gun rights, there's some interesting give and takes to this. There's some interesting interplay in how this is all ultimately going to work out. And it's fascinating to watch. And it's something that I've been trying to keep a close eye on. So first of all, what is Hunter Biden, Biden being prosecuted for? He's being prosecuted for the a violation of the federal law that says you may not lie when you go into a gun store and fill out the form. It's called a ATF form 4473. And if you've bought a gun in a gun store, you've filled one of these out, and it asks you several questions. I mean, after all the identifying information and whatnot, it asks you a series of questions, and they're essentially a list of the things that make you a prohibited possessor under federal law. For instance, it'll ask you if you've been convicted of a crime for which the maximum sentence was over a year. And that sounds complicated, but really what they're asking you is, do you have a felony conviction? Because that's how you define a felony. It's a crime for which the maximum sentence is over a year. And that can vary a little bit state to state. Some states have kept like their OWI or DUI, whatever you want to call it, those crimes have kept them labeled as misdemeanors, but they've raised the maximum sentence to up to 2 years in some states for the misdemeanor offense, like a first offense. And so anyway, the usual application of that definition is if you have a felony conviction. It asks you a series of other things. Do you have a domestic violence order or protection against you? And a whole series of other questions. One of the things it asks you is, are you a user of or addicted to any illegal drugs? And what's interesting is that it does not ask you if you're presently under the influence of drugs. It says, are you a user of or addicted to? So if you're a habitual drug user, even though you haven't used, for instance, that day, and you're not necessarily high at the moment, or you're not impaired in the driving sense, then you can still be tagged off base if you say no, because even though you haven't used that day, you are a user of or addicted to an illegal drug. And what's interesting is they've changed that question I talk about this in my Indiana gun law class. They've changed that question now to say, to add a line that says, by the way, this includes marijuana, even if you're in a state where marijuana has been legalized. And why is that? And I've mentioned this here on the show before. It's because marijuana remains a controlled substance, in other words, an illegal drug at the federal level, according to the Controlled Substances Act of 1970. In fact, and this is ludicrous, and as I always say when I'm talking about marijuana, this is not a hot button issue for me because I learned all the way back in college, if not high school, that marijuana and I don't get along. We just don't get along. It makes me want to assume a fetal position and go to sleep. But it is an issue for a lot of other people, including veterans suffering from PTSD and people who are in need of pain management and a whole lot of other people, in addition to people who just want to use it recreationally. But the question now says this includes marijuana in states where it's been legalized. And again, it's still illegal under the federal statute. And this is the ludicrous part. You can argue it's ludicrous that it's even still illegal. But it not only is it illegal, it's in the schedule of drugs that are at the very top of the list for being the most addictive and the most harmful with the least medicinal benefit. So it's up there with heroin and cocaine and meth. As silly as that is. But the law says you may not lie on that form. And the question is, are you a user of or addicted to? Secondly, there is a separate federal statute that says you may not possess a gun if you're a user of or addicted to an illegal drug. So if you go in and you lie on that question, you really are looking at two different federal charges. And we're talking about 10 years in federal prison here. You're looking at two different charges, one of which is lying on the form. Secondly, it's possessing the gun. If the gun store sells it to you and you walk out with it, now you're in possession of a gun as a prohibited possessor. That's a crime. Lying on the form's a crime. He's being accused of both. Because in his book, he came out and admitted that he was addicted to, I believe cocaine was his drug of choice. I would stand to be corrected on that if you know more than me. But he came out in his book and he did a whole media tour promoting his book. And you remember the quote where he's talking about, oh yeah, I remember sifting through my carpet looking for little bits of cocaine and probably snorted more Parmesan cheese that had fallen off of pizzas than cocaine in those days. Ha ha. And in some talk show, he's making that quote, or at least humorous reference. And so he's admitted that at this precise point in time, he was severely addicted to illegal drugs. So he's being prosecuted. The argument yesterday that Hunter Biden's lawyers tried, it was that he was being selectively and vindictively targeted for prosecution of a crime that just very rarely, if ever, gets prosecuted. And on that score, he's right in the sense that I've seen statistics that of those people where you're filling out the form and he says, essentially, do you have a felony conviction, a crime for which you could have been sentenced to more than a year? And people say no, they get rejected. Or people that lie on anything else on there, no, I don't have a domestic violence order or protection. The people that actually get prosecuted, it's like less than 0.1%. So he had a point, his lawyers had a point, that it is selectively, he's being selectively prosecuted, but selectively and vindictively, he's being prosecuted by Merrick Garland's Justice Department. This is Joe Biden's Justice Department. And so he's essentially saying, my father's administration is vindictively prosecuting me just because I'm a Biden. Does that make any sense? Separately, it is not a legal defense. And I hear this all the time. People get arrested for a crime and they'll say, well, that other dude did a lot worse things than me and he's not being prosecuted. And they think that's a defense. It's not a defense. You're out dealing drugs on the corner and police pull up and arrest you because they caught you dealing drugs. You can't say, hold on, there's another guy on the next corner who sells a lot more drugs than I do. That doesn't make you innocent. You either committed the crime or you didn't. And it's not a defense to say, wait a minute, why are you prosecuting me when you're not prosecuting all these other people? People always, as a defense lawyer, I hear that all the time. Oh, wait a minute, I know all these other people that did worse than me and they're not being prosecuted. That may be true, but the only issue in your case is whether you committed the crime. And that's why the judge at the end of this said that the argument his lawyers were making was quote unquote nonsensical and refused to throw it out. Now, there's a June trial date, I want to say June 3rd, which is coming right up. I mean, we're halfway through April, just about. And so June 3rd, in terms of preparing for a federal criminal court case, is right around the corner. They have yet, though, to make the argument that a lot of us are waiting to hear them make. And this is going to be fascinating as far as how this plays out with Joe Biden's efforts to actually increase gun control and limit access to firearms by U.S. citizens. It's going to be really interesting to see how it plays out with the argument that is still to be argued by Hunter Biden in court. And I'd be shocked if they don't raise this because it's a legitimate argument, much more so than what they tried yesterday unsuccessfully. We're at the quarter hour. We're going to take a break. I'll come back and talk to you about how really interesting this is going to get when Hunter Biden alleges, his lawyers argue, that the statute that makes it a lie, excuse me, makes it a crime, a felony to lie on the federal form, or makes it a crime and a felony to possess a firearm by someone as someone who's addicted to or a user of illegal drugs, when he comes back and argues that that's unconstitutional, which I'm telling you is right around the corner. That gets interesting really fast. That's what we'll go into. We always want to take your calls, 317-239-9393. That's 317-239-9393. Give us a call. Join the conversation. This is Guy Relford on the Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC.
Second to none on the Second Amendment. This is the Gun Guy with Guy Relford on 93 WIBC.
And welcome back to the Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC. So as I mentioned, we're about to see something really interesting in this case involving Hunter Biden. Because here his dad, as I always say, our beloved president, is doing everything he can to eradicate Second Amendment rights in this country. In fact, there's a quote-unquote new rule on so-called unlicensed gun dealers that just got announced last week. And I'm going to talk about that here on the show as well tonight. But what's really interesting is that having failed yesterday in court to get this gun charge against him, actually multiple charges for both lying on the form and then possessing the firearm as a prohibited possessor, having failed to get it thrown out because he's being selectively and vindictively prosecuted by his dad's administration. I'm sorry, got to laugh a little bit at that one. But the next argument he's undoubtedly going to make, and they're crazy if they don't, is that the statute that makes it a crime to possess a firearm as someone who's a user of or addicted to illegal drugs, that it's unconstitutional. And why do I say that? Well, it's because the new test for what is and is not constitutional under the Second Amendment has come out of the Bruin case here from a little over a year ago from the Supreme Court. The new test is based on the text, history, and tradition of the Second Amendment. So text, what does it say? What does it mean? And we've had previous Supreme Court cases, the Heller case from 2008, the McDonald case 2010, that help us a lot with knowing what it means. And as I'm going to talk about in another context later in the show, it protects, the Second Amendment protects those arms, bearable arms, that are commonly used for lawful purposes in the United States. Then separately, in terms of how that right has been regulated in this country, you look at the history and tradition of that regulation, and you look at two particular time frames. You look to the time of the ratification of the Second Amendment, which is 1791, and you look at the timing of the passing of the 14th Amendment, which makes the Bill of Rights, including the Second Amendment, applicable to the states. That's the 14th Amendment, and that was in 1868. So the courts, since Bruin, based on Bruin's instructions, are required to look at the text, history, and tradition of the Second Amendment and say, well, traditionally in this country, including at the time of the founding, and the years flowing from that, and from 1868, essentially after the end of the Civil War, what kind of gun regulations were seen as permissible under the Second Amendment? And can you find an analog, a comparative law or laws that say, yes, this particular law is consistent with how the Second Amendment has been regulated and how that's been accepted by the courts in this country? And that's how the test now works under the Bruin case. And here's what's interesting. Already, we've seen bits and pieces. This is the Gun Control Act of 1968 as modified by the Brady Bill in 1994 and other tweaks since then. So you're talking about the big federal statute that, among other things, defined this list of prohibited possessors. So talking about felons. Well, we've already seen decisions that say that nonviolent felons being prohibited from possessing firearms, that's unconstitutional, because if you don't have a history of violence, and if you're not considered to be dangerous, there's not a history and tradition in this country of depriving you of your Second Amendment rights. There's a case right now, it's already been argued, in fact, we should see an opinion here sooner than later, from the Supreme Court, deals with someone who's under a domestic violence order of protection. He was never convicted of a crime, and in fact, he went through a civil proceeding where you do not have a right to counsel, you have much fewer, if any, due process protections that you would have in a criminal case. But he had a domestic violence order of protection entered against him in a civil proceeding in which he was not represented by counsel. And the question is it consistent with the history and tradition of regulation of gun rights in this country to deprive this person, who, not based on a criminal conviction, but just based on a domestic violence order of protection that was entered after a civil proceeding. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals down in Texas, a court that oversees Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, and the federal courts in those districts, said, no, that's unconstitutional. And the nonviolent felon thing, again, there are two cases right now that the Supreme Court is considering whether to take that both deal with nonviolent felons. And I've talked about these briefly before. One person lied on an application for food stamps. Another one, 20 or 30 years ago, wrote a bad check to a grocery store. And they both got felony convictions out of that, but they're prohibited possessors. They're not violent. They're not dangerous. And in one case, it was found to be constitutional in the lower court. In the other, it was found to be unconstitutional. Our own Supreme Court Justice, Amy Coney Barrett, one of the more recently named Supreme Court justices, wrote a dissenting opinion when she was on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the federal circuit that includes Indiana. She wrote a dissenting opinion that said nonviolent felons being prohibited from possessing firearms is unconstitutional under the text, history, and tradition test. So now you've got Hunter Biden looking at 10 plus years in prison, potentially. First offenders, no criminal history, you're probably not going to get the whole megillah, but you could get a chunk of time in federal prison for violating these laws. An argument he has available to him, and it's a pretty damn good argument, is that it's not consistent with the history and tradition of regulation of Second Amendment for someone who may on occasion use drugs, but is not presently incapacitated. Because you can find some analogs of, well, no, it's okay to not sell a gun to someone who's drunk. All right, well, that makes sense. And that goes back to the time of the formation. What about if they just drink on occasion, but they're not presently drunk? Are they a prohibited possessor? Well, that gets it pretty interesting pretty fast. But get this, if Hunter Biden were to challenge this, let's say it goes up, let's say the Supreme Court takes that case and agrees with Hunter Biden, then, oh no, it's not consistent with the text, history, and tradition of the Second Amendment for us to deprive Second Amendment rights of people who are not presently incapacitated, but are just generally users or addicted to illegal drugs. including marijuana, then that law is unconstitutional. Joe Biden's son will have just made available the Second Amendment rights to potentially hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of drug users in this country. How do you think dad's going to feel about that? And I think that's absolutely hilarious. Do I think the court would look for an excuse not to go that direction? I could see it. But it could play out that way. And it's just so fascinating to me to look at the machinations going in, I'm sure, among the defense team for Hunter Biden, saying, all right, you know, our job is to make the best arguments we can to avoid our client being convicted of a serious crime. At the same time, the Biden administration going, hold up, you're going to argue what? And I think that's some fascinating interplay. We're a little past the bottom of the hour. We're going to take a break. Come back. We're going to shift gears. We're going to talk about, you will never believe who Moms Demand Action, you know, Moms Demand Action was founded as Million Moms for Gun Control, but they got abused pretty badly on social media for naming themselves that because they were at the time about 990,000 people short of a million. And so they decided to change the name to Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. You never believe who they're quoting. In fact, they played a snippet, a quotation, in their latest promotion for members of Moms Demand Action. If you haven't already seen my post on social media, either at Twitter or X, I guess, or Facebook, this may come as a bit of a surprise, who Moms Demand Action is quoting in order to gain members for a gun control group, Moms Demand Action. That's what we'll go into when we come back. I'm going to take your calls, 317-239-9393, 317-239-9393. This is Guy Relford on The Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC.
Your rights, your responsibilities, your guns. This is The Gun Guy with Guy Relford on 93 WIBC.
And welcome back. I'm Guy Relford on The Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC. We're thrilled you're with us. And I want to get into what I found completely fascinating, which is Moms Demand Action. You know, this actually is founded by a lady who at the time, Shannon Watts, at the time lived in Zionsville, same town I live in. And I believe this was after Sandy Hook, a horrific school shooting. But she had been a big PR person, I want to say, for Monsanto Company. I mean, she'd had some fairly high-profile corporate jobs, and she portrayed herself as just a stay-at-home mom, which she was anything but historically for her as far as her career goes. Not that there's absolutely anything wrong whatsoever with stay-at-home moms. They're part of what makes this country as exceptional as it is, and we love our stay-at-home moms, so nothing negative there at all. But she founded this group, and again, it originally was, I believe it was called Million Moms for Gun Control, and they didn't have anywhere near to a million people, so they got beat up pretty hard on that. But they are a gun control group. They ended up getting sort of brought into the Bloomberg organization. Michael Bloomberg, who started Mayors Against Illegal illegal guns, he was a former mayor of New York, a huge gun control proponent, and a billionaire. If you follow the Bloomberg publications, that's who we're talking about. And he's a huge gun control proponent. And so he actually brought in Moms Demand Action into his organizations. And I think that's who's footing the bill. That's who's writing the checks. But they came out promoting their organization and looking for members. And in doing so, and this is on the, this isn't Moms Demand Action Indiana, this is on their national Twitter feed. They came out and with a Twitter post that says, "No one can deny the power and significance of our grassroots army of volunteers who show up each and every time gun safety is on the line in their states." And it says, join us in your state, simply text, yada, yada, yada. So they're looking for volunteers. But they said, no one can deny the power and significance of our grassroots army. And they then have played over the top of a number of pictures of the moms with their red T-shirts on in various legislatures around the country. They actually play 46 seconds of a snippet from my show. And I had several people send this to me, and it was fascinating to me because the context of what, and I'll play it for you here so you can hear the whole thing. The context of what I was talking about is I was talking about the need for gun owners and people that support the Second Amendment to be active and to show up when gun-related bills are in the legislature. I was talking about the need for butts in seats and for people to be there in the legislature, people to be sending emails, yes, people to be calling their legislators, absolutely. Fill out the voter surveys, you bet, 100%. But a lot of what we were looking for over time was people to show up. And in that context, I was giving the devil their due a bit. I was giving Moms Demand Action some credit because I was saying, look, here's who's on the other side. Because whatever you want to say about these people, they are habitually wrong about everything. And it's really, it's interesting. And you don't want to be hard-hearted about it. But what they do for every gun-related bill, they have, again, they show up. You got to give them credit for that. They've all got their red T-shirts on. They fill the meeting rooms, the hearing rooms, and whatnot. And but what they traditionally do is we've got some gun-related bill, and one after the other of these people will get up to testify, and the testimony is always completely unrelated to the particular bill that's being debated. It's basically just guns are bad, guns are dangerous, or, you know, I suffered a terrible loss as a result of gun violence. And you'll hear people get up and they tell heart-wrenching stories. I take nothing away from the emotional impact of what they have to say. You know, I had a 15-year-old who was at a birthday party at a skating rink, and someone drove by and fired shots into the big crowd at the skating rink, and my son was paralyzed. I mean, I've seen that lady. I've spoken at some of the same events where she's been. She's testified for bills. I respect everything about her. And she's experiencing something absolutely horrific. But what you always want to ask, and sometimes legislators have the courage to ask, is that's a horrible story, and everyone is impacted by the heart-wrenching story that you just told, but that factual scenario has absolutely nothing to do with the bill that we're debating. And the strategy seems to be if they just convince legislators that guns are bad and that bad people use guns to do bad things, that they'll want to pass laws that have nothing to do with the story they just told. And you hear that over and over and over again. And no, again, no one wants to be insensitive to losses that people have suffered, to loved ones. I mean, I'm not built like that. I can't just turn a blind eye to that. But it's not an argument for gun control when you're talking about passing laws that no criminal's ever going to follow to begin with and has nothing to do with the scenario that they want to complain about. And most of our legislators in Indiana have been very good about making that distinction of that's horrible, but it has nothing to do with the bill we're debating today. And so they're habitually wrong on every issue. And they don't have particularly effective speakers. If some of the same people get up and speak and it's just guns are bad, and everybody kind of sits there, you know, on whatever committee we're in front of and goes, okay, we've heard you say that many times in the past. But in calling for more activism among gun owners, I was given Moms Demand Action credit for what they are good at, which is showing up. Because you know what? Gun owners, we're really good at voting. And that's where I think our power comes from, because politicians know we vote. We're really good at voting. We're really good at whining on the internet. A lot of people, man, gun-related pages, oh, man, whining about the left, whining about the right, whining about this law or that law, and we're rock star whiners as gun owners. But we also vote, and that's huge. But you know what we're not very good at? And this is the point I was making in this snippet you're about to hear. We're not very good at showing up. That's one of the reasons I founded the 2A Project. And we made a big difference. When we got constitutional carry passed, and this is the point I was making, is that it changed, man. We had people in the blue t-shirts with the 2A Project on them and Lady Liberty on the front with our damn rifle, thank you very much, and Shall Not Be Infringed on the back. And I'm proud of that shirt, and a lot of people bought them, and a lot of people showed up at the legislature. But I was in calling for more activism among gun owners. I was given MDA their due.
I'm really frustrated. And you've heard me talk about this here on the Gun Guy Show before. I'd show up to these committee hearings. I mean, we fought for constitutional carry for 10 years. Or even like, well, I was fighting for the self-defense immunity bill that I wrote, and you've heard me talk about many times here. It was introduced and championed by Jim Lucas. We'd show up to fight for that bill. It'd be me, the local NRA guy, and an entire room full of ladies or people in red t-shirts to say Moms Demand Action. And let me tell you, they're vocal, man. They clap, they boo, they make it obvious where their sentiments lie and what they want legislators to do. And the dynamics in the room make a difference.
And that's why the point I was making was we need more on our side showing up. But they post that snippet with this little photograph montage saying, no one can deny the power and significance of our grassroots army. Oh, I'm sorry, folks. I will deny the power and significance all day long. You know why? Because we won every one of those battles. You fought us on constitutional carry. It took longer than it should have, not because of you, not because of Moms Demand Action. It was because we had cowardly Republicans in charge in the General Assembly for too many years. But we got it done. I talked about the self-defense immunity bill. Man, they fought like hell against that. They said it was going to promote vigilante justice. Has it done that in the 5 years since it passed? Hell no. It's protected law-abiding citizens who defend themselves and their family from frivolous lawsuits, exactly as we said it would. So we've won every battle. So bragging about the power and significance of MDA, I'm sorry, the facts don't bear that out. Not here in Indiana, I guarantee you. But it's fascinating that I apparently am the new love child of Moms Demand Action because they're quoting me when they're out looking for members. I found that fascinating. I'll tell you what, we got way past the three-quarter hour. We'll take a break. We'll come back for a very short segment, and I think we got a caller or two. We'll see if we have time to fit that in when we come back. We'll be right back. This is Guy Relford on The Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC.
Now, you got a gun guy. Guy Relford on 93 WIBC.
And welcome back. As I mentioned, we have a real short segment here at the top of the hour. We come back, I'm going to talk about a new rule, quote unquote, put out by the Biden administration that has to do with unlicensed dealers. And actually, Joseph has called in with a question that I think bears directly on this. Joseph, if you're listening, man, if you wouldn't mind being patient through the break at the top of the hour, we've only got less than a minute here before we have to break, and I don't want to have a that short of a conversation with you. But unlicensed dealers, what exactly are we talking about there? And is this really a change at all in terms of a new ATF rule? That's what we'll get into when we come back. Right now, we're at the top of the hour. We're taking a break. This is Guy Relford on The Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. This is the Second Amendment, and this is The Gun Guy.
Boom, 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 boom. Bang, 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 bang. Boom, 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 boom. Bang, bang, bang.
With Guy Relford on 93 WIBC.
And welcome back for hour number two of The Gun Guy Show here on 93 WIBC. We're glad you're with us. And the Biden administration here just this last week announced what they're calling a new rule. Now, when they say rule, what are they talking about? Well, there are the laws passed by Congress, but then administrative agencies have their own rules in terms of how they interpret and or enforce those statutes. And the ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, actually the full name of which is Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. So BATFE is the appropriate acronym. But what we all call ATF, they've been real active in the rural area over the last several years, because that's where we've got all these complete abominations, starting, frankly, with one that ATF did at President Trump's bidding, which was to make bump stocks illegal. And what a lot of us said at the time is this was a horrible precedent, and it was very disappointing that President Trump is the one who ordered it. But after the Las Vegas shooting, where a bump stock or multiple bump stocks were allegedly used, President Trump came out and said, oh, bump stocks are gone. I'm telling the ATF to make these illegal. Well, that's not ATF's job. That's Congress's job to make something illegal. Congress had made machine guns illegal unless they're registered under the National Firearms Act, and they had amended the National Firearms Act to say that no new machine guns would be registered after April of 1986. So if you're going to define something as a machine gun, and it wasn't registered already before 1986, it's going to be illegal. Well, there weren't any bump stocks around in 1986. So by saying, and this is what ATF did, they said that bump stocks make a gun a machine gun. So they're an accessory whose only use is to take a semi-automatic rifle and convert it to a machine gun. That makes it illegal under the National Firearms Act. To do so, they had to completely bastardize. They had to completely change the definition of machine gun. And that's not the ATF's job to change the law passed by Congress. Congress defined what a machine gun is. And they had to go through this ridiculous twist of logic to say, oh no, bump stocks make a semi-automatic an automatic. They don't. Still takes a separate function of the trigger to produce the next round. But anyway, the ATF didn't stop there. And again, this was horrible. This was a precedent under President Trump because Biden took full advantage of it. That's where we got the pistol brace fiasco. That's where we got the ghost gun regulation. And it goes on and on. And so what we've now seen is presidents who want to pass gun control are just telling the ATF to make it happen on an administrative agency regulation basis. And that's not the way it's supposed to work. And under the vesting clause of the Constitution, the legislative power shall be vested in the Congress. When you got executive agencies, these are agencies that report to the president, the executive. They're not part of Congress. They're part of the executive branch. When they're changing the law, the laws that can put people in jail for 10 years, that's not the way the founders envisioned it. And that was a big mistake Trump made by starting down that road. And Biden's taken full advantage of it. Well, what he's also now done is they've come out with a new rule. And I haven't seen the rule yet. I've just seen media on this. And I'm assuming the actual text of the rule is going to be available this week. And I'll have more to say once I get into the specifics. What they're saying now is unlicensed dealers, including at gun shows, unlicensed dealers will now have to perform background checks. And I saw that announcement and I'm like, hold up. This is not a new rule. It's simply saying that they're going to enforce existing law. And why do I say that? It's because there's really no such thing as a legal, unlicensed dealer. If you're a dealer of firearms and you don't have a federal firearms license, you're breaking the law. You're looking at 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine today. And I've been warning people since the closing days of the Obama administration that they're cracking down on this. They've been cracking down on this for years, and they're continuing to do so, and they're going to accelerate the extent to which they're cracking down. Why do I say that? Because they're looking at people who were buying and selling a significant number of guns, saying you're a dealer, meaning you're engaged in the business of selling firearms. You don't have a license. You're going to jail. And it's the license, having a federal firearms license, is what compels you, legally compels you, to do background checks on every person you sell a gun to, because dealers have to do that. Private individuals don't. But if you're engaged in the business, you have to have a license. So saying unlicensed dealers have to start doing background checks makes no sense to me, because it suggests that unlicensed dealers have been legal before now. And I think this is a good time to go to Joseph's question, who has called in with a question about private sales. Joseph, man, thanks so much for your patience, my brother, and welcome to the Gun Guy Show.
Well, you're scaring me. Am I an unlicensed dealer just because I might want to sell a gun to somebody? I was at Indy Arms this morning, and I was looking at some pistols, and there was a young man standing there, 18 or 19, talking to the salesman about the finer points of owning a pistol between the ages of 18 and 21.
Yeah.
And it turns out, from what the salesman said, you can buy one at 18, but you can't buy it through an FFL.
That's right. Under federal law, under federal law, the dealer can't sell a handgun to a person under 21.
But I could sell it to him.
Right.
But I couldn't do an FFL check through the store on him.
Right.
So I'm wondering, if he seemed like a nice young man, and I've got a pistol, it's too small for me, it's just a little subcompact, and he's worried about riding around Indianapolis with his new wife in the car. And I'm thinking, well, I've got a pistol I could sell you. Meet me here next Saturday if you want to see it. And now I'm wondering, I can't do a background check on him. If I sell him a pistol and he does something nefarious with it, what does that mean for me?
Yeah, well, first of all, the law in Indiana is that you can't transfer a firearm, a handgun in particular, to a person who's ineligible to purchase their own handgun from a dealer, except for reasons of age. So the Indiana legislature carved out exactly the scenario you're talking about, Joseph, where they said, well, no, if somebody is a felon or they're whatever, they're a prohibited possessor and can't buy their own gun from a dealer, then you can't sell them a handgun either, except if they're only ineligible to buy a handgun from a dealer for reasons other than age. So the law says, yes, I can sell a gun to an 18, 19, 20-year-old. I can't know that they're ineligible for some other reason, like they're a felon or whatever. But if I don't know, and there's no obligation to check, and a lot of people would comment to say there ought to be, and that's why you're talking about, well, yeah, but how do you do that? Because you can't do a NICS check. You know, the FBI, if you call the FBI, the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, run by the FBI out of Wheeling, West Virginia, and said, hey, I want to sell a gun to this guy, I want to do a background check on him, they'll go, well, are you an FFL? And you say no, and they're going like, we don't do that. So what a lot of us have done over the years, Joseph, is we've said, well, let me see your Indiana license to carry handgun. Because you can get one of those at 18. Now, again, we have constitutional carry now. But
you don't even need that now.
What's that?
He doesn't even need that now, right?
Yeah, well,
they have a license to carry.
Yeah, but licenses are still available. So you can say, show me a license to carry, because a lot of people go out and get their licenses when they're 18. That tells you that he's had a background check run by the state police of Indiana, and then you know they're eligible. And what a lot of us have done in addition with that is saying, I also need to see your Indiana driver's license, because the license to carry doesn't have a picture on it. So that the driver's license is telling you two things. They're an Indiana resident, since it's illegal to sell a handgun to a resident of a different state. And it also telling you that they're the same person whose name's on the license. That's how you get around that. But the law says you just can't know that they're ineligible for a reason other than age. Now, that's one point. That's selling a gun, transferring a gun to an ineligible person. The other point is, are you now engaged in the business because you just sold a gun to this guy? One gun, you know, in that context, is not going to get you anywhere close to ATF or FBI or the federal government saying, oh, yeah, you're engaged in the business. But get this, Joseph, there's no particular number. Like people look at it and say, you know, like, I don't know, somebody told me one time that if you sell more than 10 cars in a year, you got to be, you know, a licensed automobile dealer. I have no idea whether that's true or not. I've just been told that. And I'm sure that, you know, and or selling houses, you know, you sell X number, and I don't know, maybe you have to have a realtor's license. I don't know. I don't know how any of those things work. But there's no particular number when it comes to guns. It's just the statute says if you're repetitively buying and selling firearms, the principal motivation of making a profit. So if you're doing that, and do we know the number? No, because it's not published anywhere. If you go to part of it has to do with how you hold yourself out. If you go to a gun show and set up a table, I go to a gun show and I set up a table that says Guys Guns, and I have business cards printed up. Guys Guns, best deals in the Midwest. And I'm sitting there and I'm taking credit cards or whatever, and I got my cash box, and I sell one gun to somebody. There is a possibility I could be prosecuted, and there's precedent for this, for being engaged in the business because I'm holding myself out essentially as a dealer. But that's under existing law, and it's all existed well before this supposed new change. So the new change saying unlicensed dealers have to do background checks, we're a little past the quarter hour, we come back, we'll talk about, does that really change anything, or does it not at all? And that's what we'll get into. We come back. And thanks to Joseph for his patience and for the excellent question. We have more people that have called in. We'll go back to the phone lines as well. Right now, we're taking a break. This is Guy Relford on The Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC.
Now, you've got a gun guy. Guy Relford on 93 WIBC.
And welcome back. Man, this show is flying. I have a lot more I want to get into, but I'll tell you what, we always like it when we have folks call in. So let's go back to the phone lines, and Fred has called the Gun Guy Show. Man, Fred, welcome.
Thank you, Guy.
Yeah, what you got for us?
My question is, the Fifth Amendment says you can't self-incriminate yourself, so is it possible that lying on a form could be a defense against Hunter Biden or for Hunter Biden?
Oh, I see what you're saying. So, like the question, are you a user of or addicted to illegal drugs? If you say yes, you've just confessed to a drug crime, right? So
correct.
You're being compelled to be a witness against yourself. It's an interesting question, Fred. Is that what you were asking? I'm gonna make sure I got it right first.
That's correct. Thank
yeah. Okay. That's what I thought. I don't think that would fly, Fred. It's an interesting question, and I'm glad you raise it. I don't think so, because the Fifth Amendment doesn't say you can't incriminate yourself. It says you can't be compelled to incriminate yourself, and that's by the government. And I'm sure you're thinking, well, hold on. I mean, if you have to fill out the form to buy the gun, and the government's telling you they have to fill the form out, then they're saying you can't lie on the form or else you go to prison. Therefore, just answer the truth is to confess to a crime. You're being compelled to confess to the crime. I don't think that would hold up. In fact, I'm 99.9% sure it wouldn't hold up, Fred. And the reason is because you're not compelled to buy a gun, and you're not compelled to buy a gun from a dealer. So you've made the decision to go in and purchase a gun from a dealer. And if you are a user of or addicted to illegal drugs and you're doing that, then ostensibly you're attempting to commit a crime. And that's why I don't think the compelling part, that is the government compelling you to be a witness against yourself or to incriminate yourself, would hold up, because you're the government's not compelling you to go buy the gun to begin with. So that's where I think legally that just wouldn't hold up. Let's go back to the phone lines. Bud has called in. Bud, welcome to the Gun Guy Show.
Yeah, hey, Guy. Just curious if you've come across this Missouri bill, Senate Bill 727, changing the definition of homeschool to school and banning firearms in such schools.
Yeah, I've seen, Bud, some social media on it, and I took a brief look at it. Be honest with you, I have a hard enough time keeping on top of everything that's going on in Congress at the federal level and here in Indiana without chasing down what's going on in the other 49 states. But I know, sure. I know exactly what you're talking about. And, you know, this is interesting because this is actually an issue that came up during COVID because people were concerned with, hold on, if my kid is attending school at home now, does that make my home a school for purposes of the Gun-Free School Zones Act, either the state one or the federal one? And do I, am I now looking at, you know, 10 years in prison because I've got guns in my home and my kids attending school, you know, virtually through the computer while they're sitting at home? So people looked at that, and the answer is no, because typically that only refers to a licensed school. For instance, here in Indiana, you have to be a licensed school or a licensed daycare. Now, it does include private, parochial, and public schools, so it doesn't have to be a public school, but it has to be a licensed school for it to be considered a school. What they're doing in Missouri in terms of how they're actually changing the homeschool law, I do not know. If they're making them they meet their definition of school for purposes of their version of a Gun-Free School Zones Act, then I could say, yeah, that is an issue. I will tell you one thing, and this is something, you know, I brag on some of the good changes we've made to Indiana law over the years. One thing I fought for, and this is it's probably 8 years ago or so now, maybe more. I don't remember talking about it on the show, and I've had the show coming up on 9 years, so maybe it was more than that. But the definition, the definitions of the Indiana version of Gun-Free School Zones Act, where it's illegal under Indiana law to have a gun on school property. Again, there's a federal statute as well. They're very different. You have to comply with both, obviously. But the Indiana statute that said it's a felony to possess a gun on school property, it used to say that applied to school property. That's the actual property owned by the school. School bus. And then it also included property being used by a school for a school function. And think about that a little bit. Property being used by a school for a school function. So would your kid attending classes virtually during COVID be property being used by a school for a school function? Well, hell, if they're sitting there for six or seven or however many hours a day attending school, there's certainly an argument that that would be included. But I fought for and worked with some Pro 2A legislators to get that taken out of the statute. And I was using examples like, man, I'm at the art museum, minding my own business. I'm lawfully carrying my handgun with my license as required at the time. And I'm totally law abiding. I'm totally compliant with the law. But all of a sudden, a couple of school buses pull up and some junior high school kids come trundling into the art museum as part of a field trip. Now, is that property being used by a school for a school function? Sure it is. Am I now committing a felony because some school kids showed up to the place where I was lawfully exercising my Second Amendment rights before the school kids got there? I'm in a restaurant and buses pull up and now a bunch of elementary kids walk in. They're stopping to get lunch, coming back from the zoo as part of a field trip. Is that restaurant now property being used by a school for a school function? I'm staying at a hotel and a high school is having their prom there in the ballroom. Isn't that hotel now property being used by a school for a school function? So I use those examples in arguing in the legislature for why that ought to be taken out when we did successfully several years ago. And I think that helps us a lot if anybody ever tried to make the argument that homeschooling somehow made the home a school for purposes of the current bill, the current law. Now, if they could change the law, as apparently they're trying to do in Missouri, and that would be an issue. But surely, I don't know. I'm not sure exactly the statewide politics in Missouri, but I'd have a hard time believing that that gun owners in Missouri would allow that to happen. But we'll have to keep an eye on that, although it's not a huge priority for me since I'm really focused on federal law and Indiana. We're a little past the bottom of the hour, so we're taking a break. This is Guy Relford on The Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC.
He's a Second Amendment attorney. He's an NRA-certified firearms instructor. He's The Gun Guy. Guy Relford on 93 WIBC.
And welcome back. I'm Guy Relford on The Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC. And talking about this quote-unquote new rule that the Biden administration in particular is saying is going to, quote, close the gun show loophole. So what are they talking about? What does this do? What does it not do? I don't think it changes anything, frankly. But it may denote a change in, or at least an increased level of enforcement of ATF of existing law. But it doesn't change the law in any way. The head of the Brady Group, the Brady campaign, came out and said, this rule will save lives by ensuring those who engage in the business of selling firearms are taking the necessary precautions we require of all other licensed gun dealers. In doing so, we can mitigate the proliferation of firearms in our communities and yada, yada, yada. Well, to require unlicensed dealers to do background checks is kind of a non sequitur. What we're really talking about doing is simply prosecuting people who are engaged in the business of selling firearms who don't have a license. And that form of prosecution has been available to the federal government for decades and decades. I know because I've defended the cases. I have three of these cases pending right now. Well, people are accused, and these are, they fall into two categories. I started to say these are typically people who, yes, go to gun shows, set up tables, and sell a bunch of guns. And have been doing so for a while. But it's not just that. Because the new form of prosecution I'm seeing is where the ATF is focused on people who have bought and sold a whole bunch of guns on internet sites like Arms List or Gun Broker. And let me tell you, the ATF, I mean, this should be obvious, is monitoring the hell out of Arms List and Gun Broker. And I guarantee you, there's some of the pages on Facebook where Facebook supposedly ruled out, you know, selling guns on Facebook. You used to see a lot of it before Facebook changed its policy. And now people are on there and they kind of have this dumb code system where they'll say, I don't know, how many beans did you cook in your chili tonight? You know, oh, by the way, here's my Glock Model 2145. And they're basically saying, you know, offer, you know, how much money will you give me for this gun? I mean, they're kind of goofy, and I think Facebook pretty much always figures them out and closes down those pages. And I'm the moderator on a couple of gun related pages on Facebook, and you have to have a very strict no gun sale policy. But my point is, whatever internet site, certainly the actual gun selling sites like Arms List and Gun Broker, ATF is monitoring those. They're seeing who's got guns up for sale. They're seeing who's sold a bunch of guns. But I'll tell you what they're also focused on. They're focused on tracing back guns found at crime scenes. And they're really focused on Chicago crime scenes when it comes to Indiana. And I know this because I have represented clients caught up in this, where they find that three or four guns over some period of time were recovered at crime scenes in Chicago. It doesn't matter where, but they'll trace those back to who bought those guns originally from an FFL, because they'll find the 4473 form that you filled out there at the gun dealer. And if you've sold X number of guns, it almost doesn't matter, but if you've bought multiple guns from an FFL, then sold them in private transactions, and multiple guns show up at crime scenes, you're going to get a knock on the door from ATF. It's just happening. It's happening left and right. And this has been going on. I mentioned the close of the Obama administration. Obama was focused on, quote unquote, closing the gun show loophole, too. And so what they did is they simply put out, the ATF put out what was called a guidance document. It was in late 2015. It may have actually come out after the first of the year. But this was in response to an executive order issued by President Obama. And it was called, Do I Need a Firearms License? And it was a guidance document, quote unquote, telling people how the ATF enforces the law that says if you're engaged in the business of selling firearms, you have to have a license. And if you don't have a license and you're engaged in the business, you go to prison. I even worry about this for some people I know that are acquaintances that just always seem to have four or five guns on GunBroker. And listen, I've never bought a gun off GunBroker. I've never sold a gun on ArmsList or GunBroker. I've never bought a gun from ArmsList. But I'll go look at prices occasionally and whatnot. I'll go look at them. And you know what? You notice some people just always have three or four guns out there. I'll guarantee you the ATF is noticing that too. They got people whose job it is to monitor those sites. So this new rule focused on gun shows, apparently, saying that unlicensed dealers have to do background checks. That's not really what they're talking about. That's the way they're framing it, because they think that sounds better, because people like the require background checks part. But all they're talking about doing is enforcing existing law that says if you're engaged in the business, you have to have a license. And if you don't, you're looking at 5 years in prison, as I mentioned. And by the way, is there a gun show loophole? No. There's nothing specific about a gun show that changes the law. If I'm doing something that would be illegal, if I'm engaged in the business of selling guns at gun shows, first of all, ATF's there, man. If there's a gun show going on, you can just count on it. ATF's there. They're taking pictures. They're monitoring people. I've had clients who were at these things where they came up or someone came up saying, hey, man, I've got a felony, but, you know, I'll pay a little extra for this gun if you sell it to me anyway. You know the likelihood that that's an ATF agent? It's not 100, but I put it pretty damn close. That's what they're doing at gun shows. And listen, even according to the guidance document that came out 2015, 2016, under Obama, even then they said, listen, well, you know, the ATF has always said that it doesn't count. You're not engaged in the business if you're simply liquidating a private collection. I've had people call me and say, you know, my dad died and dad has 100 guns in his collection. Can I sell all 100 of those guns? Well, yeah, if you'd rather have the money than the guns, you can, quote unquote, liquidate that private collection. And even though you sold 100 guns, you're not considered to be engaged in the business of selling firearms because you're simply liquidating a private collection. But people have taken that. And listen, if you go to gun shows, you've seen the same people that I have at gun shows. They've got this, a lot, the ones I see all the time, they got these carved wooden signs that they sit out on a table that says liquidating private collection. And these guys have trailers that they pull all over the state or, hell, who knows, maybe all over the region or the country. And they go to gun shows and they sell guns and they buy guns. And they just set this sign out that says liquidating private collection. And they think that's some magic wand that protects them from being prosecuted because their sign says liquidating private collection. That's not the way it works. If ATF sits there and monitors you and videos you selling X number of guns at this gun show, then they see you buying guns and setting those guns out on the table at the next gun show, they're going to accuse you of violating federal law and take you to jail. And that's under existing law right now. But for those folks who just enjoy the buying and selling of guns, and I know people like this, They like getting new guns. They like turning them over, get something different than that, upgrading, whatever it might be. ATF is paying a lot of attention to this. And in particular, where you've sold a number of guns and they show up at crime scenes, there's going to be a knock on the door. And there may be a subpoena associated with it. There may be an indictment associated with it. I know, I see it. People hire me when it's happened to them. So it's a word to the wise, and apparently that's only going to accelerate. And what the Brady campaign's already talking about and Biden's already talking about is that this is a leapfrog from requiring background checks from private dealers. So again, there's no such thing ever as a legal private dealer. If you're a dealer, you have to be licensed. That's the way it's always been. And all these announcements from the Biden administration really, I think, are mischaracterizing the law as it exists. But they're saying, well, we're now going to require unlicensed dealers to do background checks, which really is just requiring them to have FFLs, and FFLs have to do background checks. And that's been the law all along. But this is a way to leapfrog from that directly into universal background checks, to where even like the gentleman who called and said, hey, there's an 18, 19-year-old who's interested in potentially buying a gun. Can I sell that to him? Under universal background checks, even though that person's nowhere close to being engaged in the business as a dealer, he wants to sell one gun to one person. Universal background checks would require a background check in that situation as well. And guess what? There's no way universal background checks are enforceable. They're specifically not enforceable unless you have universal registration. Why? Because there's no way to prove who sold what gun to whom unless you know who owns every gun, just like vehicles are registered. So without registration, you can't enforce universal background checks. Universal background checks is a way to leapfrog then into universal registration, and you and I both know what registration is used for. When the government has a list of everyone who owns guns, what possibly could happen with how the government would use that list? You know it, and I know it, and that's where we're heading, folks, without any doubt about it. Right now, we're taking a break. When we come back, I'm going to play for you a bit. I saw posted on Twitter. I've had a thousand people send this to me in different forms that may be the best mic drop moment on a gun control issue or a Second Amendment issue I've heard in a long time. We'll be back with that when we come back. This is Guy Relford on The Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC.
Second to none on the Second Amendment. This is The Gun Guy with Guy Relford on 93 WIBC.
And welcome back for the last segment of the Gun Guy Show here. Again, this has absolutely flown by. But I want to leave you with a feel-good moment, if you care about your Second Amendment rights. And this has to do with a guy that a lot of us sort of love to hate. Hate's too strong of a word. He's certainly annoying. But David Hall, you know who that is. He was one of the Parkland kids. And it was a big debate. He said he was in the high school, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, when that horrific shooting happened. A lot of people disputed that and said he really wasn't even in the school at all. He ran over there after the shooting and wanted to jump in the middle of it. But he, you know, was on the cover of Time magazine with some of the other so-called Parkland kids and was involved in the March for Our Lives in Washington, D.C. And ultimately got accepted to Harvard. And I saw articles that said he had like something like a C or B minus average and still got into Harvard because apparently Harvard was real excited about his gun control efforts. Well, he was having an open forum in New Hampshire talking about gun control. And one Lily Tang Williams, a Chinese immigrant, had this to say.
Hi, my name is Lily Tang Williams. Welcome to my live free or die state. Actually, I am a Chinese immigrant who survived communism. And under Mao, you know, 40 million people were starving to death after he sold the communism to them. And 20 million people died, murdered during his Cultural Revolution. So my question to you, David, is that can you guarantee me a gun owner tonight? Our government in the U.S., in D.C., will never, never become a tyrannical government. Can you guarantee that to me?
There's no way I can ever guarantee that any government will not be tyrannical.
Well, then the debate on gun control is over because I will never give up my guns. Never, never. And you should go to China to see how gun control works for dictatorship of CCP.
There you go. Can you guarantee me a government will not become tyrannical? No, I can't guarantee you that. The gun control debate is over. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Lily Tang Williams. That's it for this week's edition of The Gun Guy Show. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you come back. This is Guy Relford on 93 WIBC.